all doomed. Hunter's sole chance depended on the warship halting overnight. Time passed. He waited. Eventually, he was aware of a change in the gurgle of the water and a shift in the creaking of the rigging. He sat up, listening carefully. There was no doubt of it. The ship was slowing. The soldiers, huddled together and speaking quietly, noticed it too and commented among themselves. A moment later, the sound of the water ceased entirely, and Hunter heard the rattle of the anchor chain being let out. The anchor splashed loudly. Somewhere in his mind, Hunter made a note that he was near the bow of the ship. Otherwise, the sound would not be so distinct. More time passed. The warship rocked gently at anchor. They must be in some protected cove for the water to be so calm. Yet the ship had a deep draft, and Kazala would not bring his ship into any harbor at night unless he knew it well. He wondered where they were, and hoped it was in a cove near Turk Isle. There were several leeward coves deep enough for a ship this size. The rocking of the warship at anchor was restful. More than once he felt himself dozing off. The soldiers kept busy kicking the seamen, keeping them awake. The gloomy semi-darkness of the low deck was frequently punctuated by the grunts and groans of the crew as they were kicked. Hunter wondered about his plan. What was happening? After a further passage of time, a Spanish soldier came down and barked, "Every man to stand! Orders of Kazala! All stand to feet!" Encouraged by the boots of the soldiers, the seamen stood, one by one, bent over in the narrow deck. It was an aching, agonizingly uncomfortable posture. More time passed. The guard was changed. The new soldiers entered holding their noses and making jokes about the smell. Hunter looked at them oddly. He had long since ceased to be aware of any odor. The new guards were younger and more casual about their duties. Apparently, the Spaniards were convinced the pirates could give them no trouble. The new guards quickly turned to playing cards. Hunter looked away and watched drops of his own sweat fall to the floor. He thought of poor Trencher, but he could not work up anger or indignation or even fear. He was numb. A new soldier arrived. He was some sort of officer, and apparently he was displeased with the relaxed attitude of the young men. He barked out sharp orders, and the men hastily put aside their cards. The new officer went around the room, examining the faces of the privateers. Finally, he plucked one fellow out of the group and led him away. The man collapsed on rubbery legs when ordered to walk. The soldiers picked him up and dragged him out. The door closed. The guards made a brief display of attentiveness and then relaxed again. But they did not play cards. After a while, two of them decided to engage in a contest to see who could urinate the farthest. The target was a seaman in the corner. This game was considered fine sport by the guards, who laughed and pretended to bet enormous sums of money on the outcome. Hunter was only dimly aware of these events. He was very tired. His legs burned with fatigue and his back ached. He began to wonder why he had refused to tell Kazala the purpose of the voyage. It seemed a meaningless gesture. At that moment, Hunter's thoughts were interrupted by the arrival of another officer, who barked, "Captain Hunter!" And Hunter was led away, out of the room. As he was pushed and prodded through the decks of sleeping seamen, rocking in their hammocks, he distinctly heard, from somewhere in the ship, an odd and plaintive sound. It was the sound of a woman crying. Chapter 17. Hunter had no opportunity to reflect on the meaning of that strange sound, for he was pushed hastily onto the main deck. There, beneath the stars and the reefed sails, he noticed that the moon was low, which meant that dawn could not be more than a few hours away. He felt a sharp pain of despair.
"Englishman, come here!"
Hunter looked around and saw Kazala, standing near the mainmast, in the center of a ring of torches. At his feet, the seaman previously taken from the room lay spread-eagled on his back, firmly lashed to the deck. A number of Spanish soldiers stood about, and all were grinning broadly. Kazala himself seemed highly excited. He was breathing rapidly and shallowly. Hunter noticed that he was chewing more coca leaf.
"Englishman, Englishman," he said, speaking rapidly. "You are just in time to witness our little sport. Do you know we searched your ship? No? Well, we did, and we found many interesting things."
Oh, God, Hunter thought. No.
"You have much rope, Englishman, and you have funny iron hooks that fold up, and you have other strange things of canvas which we do not understand. But most of all, Englishman, we do not understand this."
Hunter's heart pounded. If they had found the Granados, then it would all be finished. But Kazala held out a case with four rats. The rats scampered back and forth and squeaked nervously.
"Can you imagine, Englishman, how amazed we were to find that you bring rats on your ship? We say to ourselves, why is this? Why does the Englishman carry rats to Augustine? Augustine has rats of its own, Florida rats, very good ones, yes? So I wonder, how do I explain this?"
Hunter watched as a soldier did something to the face of the seaman lashed to the deck. At first he could not see what was being done. The man's face was being rubbed or stroked. Then Hunter realized they were smearing cheese on his face.
"So," Kazala said, waving the cage in the air, "then I see that you are not kind to your friends, the rats. They are hungry, Englishman. They want food. You see how excited they are? They smell food. That is why they are excited. I think we should feed them, yes?"
Kazala set the cage down within inches of the seaman's face. The rats flung themselves at the bars, trying to get to the cheese.
"Do you see what I mean, Englishman? Your rats are very hungry. Do you not think we should feed them?"
Hunter stared at the rats and at the frightened eyes of the immobile seaman.
"I am wondering if your friend here will talk," Kazala said.
The seaman could not take his eyes off the rats.
"Or perhaps, Englishman, you will talk for him."
"No," Hunter said wearily. Kazala bent over the seaman and tapped him on the chest.
"And you, will you talk?"
With his other hand, Kazala touched the latch to the cage door. The seaman focused on the latch, watching as Kazala raised the bar slowly, a fraction of an inch at a time. Finally, the latch was released. Kazala held the door closed with a single finger.
"Your last chance, my friend."
"No,"
the seaman shrieked. "Je parle, je parle."
"Good," Kazala said, switching smoothly to French.
"Matanceros,"
the seaman said.
Kazala turned livid with rage. "Matanceros, you idiot! You expect me to believe that? To attack Matanceros?"
And abruptly, he released the door to the cage. The seaman shrieked hideously as the rats leapt to his face. He shook his head, the four furry bodies clinging to the flesh of his cheeks and scalp and chin. The rats chattered and squeaked. One was flung off, but instantly scrambled back across the man's heaving chest and bit into the neck. The seaman screamed over and over in terror, a monotonous, repeated sound. Finally, the man collapsed from shock and lay unmoving while the rats, chattering, continued to feed on his face. Kazala stood.
"Why do you all think me so stupid?" he said. "Englishman, I swear, I will have the truth of your voyage."
He turned to the guards.
"Take him below."
Hunter was hustled off the deck. As he was pushed down the narrow stairway, he had a brief glimpse over the rail of the Cassandra, lying at anchor some yards away from the warship. Chapter 18. The sloop Cassandra was essentially an open boat, with a single main deck exposed to the elements, and small storage lockers located fore and aft. These had been searched by the soldiers and the prize crew when the ship was taken during the afternoon. The crew had found all the provisions and special fittings that Kazala considered so perplexing. Soldiers swarming over the boat had searched it with great thoroughness. They had even peeked through the fore and aft hatches, which opened down into the keelson. With lanterns, they saw bilge water rising almost to the decking itself, and they made sarcastic comments about the laziness of the pirates in emptying the bilge. When the Cassandra made for the protected cove and hove to in the shadow of the warship, its prize crew of 10 spent several hours drinking and laughing by torchlight. When they finally slept in the early hours of the morning, lying on the deck on blankets in the warm night air, their sleep was heavy with rum. Although they had been ordered to post a watch, they did not bother to do so. The nearby warship offered protection enough. Thus, no member of the crew, lying on the deck, was aware of a soft gurgle from the bilge compartment, and no one saw a man with a reed in his mouth rise out of the oily, stinking water. Sanson, shivering with cold, had lain for hours with his head alongside the oilskin sack, which contained the precious grenadoes. Neither he nor the sack had been noticed. Now he was just able to lift his chin above the level of the bilge water before he struck the top of his head on the decking. He was surrounded by darkness, with no sense of orientation. Using his hands and feet, he pressed his back down against the hull, feeling its curved shape. He decided he was on the port side of the ship and moved slowly, quietly, toward the center line. Then, with exquisite slowness, he eased himself aft until his head softly bumped the rectangular indentation of the aft hatch. Looking up, he saw slats of lights from the grating of the hatch. Stars above, no sounds except a snoring seaman. He took a breath and raised his head. The hatch moved up a few inches. He could see the deck. He was staring directly into the face of a sleeping seaman, not more than a foot away. The man snored loudly. Sanson lowered the hatch again and moved forward through the bilge compartment. It took him nearly a quarter of an hour, lying on his back, pushing along with his hands, to traverse the 50 feet between the aft and fore hatches of the Cassandra. He raised the new hatch cover and looked around again. There was no sleeping seaman within 10 feet. Gently, slowly, Sanson removed the hatch cover and set it on the deck. He lifted himself out of the water and stood breathing the fresh night air. His drenched body was chilled by the breeze, but he paid no attention. All of his mind was focused on the sleeping prize crew on deck. Sanson counted 10 men. That would be about right, he thought. In a pinch, 3 men could sail the Cassandra. 5 could handle her comfortably. 10 men would be more than ample. He surveyed the positions of the men on the deck, trying to decide in which order to kill them. It was easy to kill a man quietly, but to kill one in absolute silence was not so simple. Of the 10 men, the first 4 or 5 were most crucial, for if any of them made a noise, they would raise a general alarm. Sanson removed the thin cord that served as his belt. He twisted the rope in his hands and tugged it taut between his fists. Satisfied with its strength, he picked up a belaying pin of carved hardwood and moved forward. The first soldier was not snoring. Sanson raised the man to sitting position, and he grumbled sleepily at the interruption for a moment before Sanson brought the pin crashing down on his head. The blow was fierce, but made only a dull thud as it contacted the scalp. Sanson eased the seaman back to the deck. In the darkness, he ran his hands over the skull. There was a deep indentation. Probably the blow had killed him, but he took no chances. He slipped the cord around the man's throat and squeezed tightly. Simultaneously, he laid his other hand flat on the man's chest to feel the heartbeat. A minute later, there was no pulsation. Sanson moved to the next man, crossing like a shadow over the deck. He repeated the process. It took him no more than 10 minutes to kill every man on the ship. He left them lying in positions of sleep on the deck. The last man to die was the sentry, slumped aft in a drunken stupor over the tiller. Sanson cut the man's throat and pushed him over the side. He fell into the water with a soft splash, but it was noticed by a guard on the warship deck. The guard leaned over and looked at the sloop. "Questa sta bene," he called. Sanson, taking up the sentry's position aft, waved to the guard. Although he was dripping wet and wearing no uniform, he knew it was too dark for the warship's guard to see. "Sta bene," he said sleepily. Basera, the guard said, and turned away. Sanson waited a moment, then turned his attention to the warship. It was some 100 yards away, far enough off that if the big ship turned at anchor with a change of wind or tides, she would not strike the Cassandra. Sanson was pleased to see that the Spaniards had neglected to batten down the gun ports, which were still open. If he entered through an open port on the lower gun deck, he would be able to avoid sentries on the main deck. He slipped over the side and swam quickly across to the warship, thinking briefly that he hoped the Spanish had not dumped garbage in the cove during the night. Garbage would draw sharks, and the shark was one of the few creatures in the world Sanson feared. But he made the crossing uneventfully, and he soon found himself bobbing in the water alongside the hull of the warship. The lowest gun ports were 12 feet above him. He heard the joking of the sentries on the main deck. A rope ladder was still over the side, but he dared not use it. Once he put his weight to it, it would creak and move, and the sentries on deck might hear that. Instead, he slipped forward to the anchor line and climbed that to the runners moving back from the bowsprit. These runners protruded only 4 inches from the hull surface, but Sanson managed to get a footing and maneuver back to the foresail rigging. From there, it was easy to hang and look into one of the forward gun ports. Listening intently, he soon heard the steady, measured pacing of the watch. By the footsteps, it sounded like a single sentry, circling the perimeter of the deck endlessly. Sanson waited until the watch passed him, and then eased in through the porthole and dropped down in the shadow of a cannon, gasping with exertion and excitement. Even for Sanson, to be alone in the midst of 400 of the enemy, half of them swinging gently in their hammocks before him, was an exhilarating sensation. He waited and planned his next move. Hunter waited in the fetid hold of the ship, standing crouched in the narrow space. He was desperately exhausted. If Sanson did not arrive soon, his men would be too fatigued to make an escape. The guards, now yawning and playing cards again, showed a total indifference to the prisoners, which was tempting and infuriating. If only he could get his men free while the ship still slept around him, then there might be a chance. But when the guard changed, as it might at any time, or when the ship's crew arose at dawn, then there would be no opportunity. He felt a moment of crushing defeat as a Spanish soldier entered the room. The watch was changing, and all was lost. A moment later, he realized he was wrong. This was just a single man, not an officer, and the guards who greeted him did so in desultory fashion. The new man assumed an air of considerable strutting self-importance and went around the room checking the bonds of the privateers. Hunter felt the tug of fingers feeling the ropes on his own hands, and then something cool, the blade of a knife, and his ropes were cut. Behind him, the man whispered softly, "This will cost you 2 more shares. It was Sanson. "Swear it," Sanson hissed. Hunter nodded, feeling anger and elation at the same moment. But he said nothing. He just watched as Sanson moved around the room and then stopped at the door to block it. Sanson faced the seaman and said in English, very quietly, "Do it softly. Softly." The Spanish guards looked up in stunned surprise as the privateers leapt at them. They were overpowered 3-1. It took only a moment. Immediately, the seamen began to strip off the uniforms and to dress in them. Sanson moved over to Hunter.
"I did not hear you swear it."
Hunter nodded, rubbing his wrists. "I swear. 2 shares to you."
"Good,"
Sanson said. He opened the door, put his finger to his lips, and led the seaman out of the hold. Chapter 19. Cazalla drank wine and brooded on the face of the dying lord, thinking of the suffering, the agony of the body. From his earliest youth, Cazalla had seen images of that agony, the torment of the flesh, the sagging muscles and the hollow eyes, the blood that poured from the wound in the side, the blood that dripped from the spikes in the hands and feet. This painting, in his cabin, had come as a gift from Philip himself. It was the work of His Majesty's favorite court painter, a man named Velazquez, recently deceased. To be given the painting was a mark of considerable esteem, and Cazalla had been overpowered to receive it. He never traveled unless it was at his side. It was his most treasured possession. This man, Velazquez, had not put a halo around the Lord's visage, and the coloring of the body was deathly gray-white. It was altogether realistic, but Cazalla often wished for a halo. He was surprised that a king so pious as Philip had not insisted that a halo be added. Perhaps Philip disliked the painting. Perhaps that was why he had sent it to one of his military captains in New Spain. In black moments, another thought occurred to Cazalla. He was only too aware of the gap that separated the niceties of life in Philip's court from the hard life of the men who sent him the gold and silver from the colonies to support such luxuries. One day he would rejoin the court, a rich man in his latter years. Sometimes he thought that the courtiers would laugh at him. Sometimes, in his dreams, he killed them all in bloody, angry duels. Cazalla's reverie was interrupted by the sway of the ship. The tide must be out, he thought. That meant dawn was not far off. Soon they would be underway for the day. It would be time to kill another English pirate. Cazalla intended to kill them, one by one, until someone told him the truth he wanted to know. The ship continued to move, but there was something wrong with the motion. Cazalla sensed it instinctively. The ship was not swinging around its forward anchor line. It was moving laterally. Something was very wrong. And then, at that moment, he heard a soft crunch, and the ship shuddered and was still. With a curse, Cazalla sprinted onto the main deck. There he found himself staring into the fronds of a palm tree just inches from his face. Several palm trees all lining the shore of the island. His ship was beached. He screamed in fury. The panicked crew scrambled around him. The first mate, trembling, ran over.
"Captain, they cut the anchor line."
"They?"
Cazalla shouted. When he was angry, his voice became high and thin, the voice of a woman. He ran to the opposite railing and saw the Cassandra, heeled over in a fair breeze, making for the open sea.
"They?"
"The pirates have escaped," said the mate, pale. "Escaped? How could they have escaped?"
"I don't know, my captain. The guards are all dead."
Cazalla struck the man full in the face, sending him sprawling across the deck. He was so furious he could hardly think. He stared across the water at the departing sloop.
"How could they escape?" he repeated. "God in damnation! How could they escape?"
The captain of the infantry came over.
"Sir, we are hard beached. Shall I land some men and try to push off?"
"The tide is running," Cazalla said.
"Yes, my captain."
"Well, fool, we cannot get afloat until the tide is in once more."
Cazalla cursed loudly. That would be 12 glasses. 6 hours before they could begin to free the massive ship. And even then, if the boat was hard beached, they might not get free. It was the season of the waning moon. Each tide was less full than the last. Unless they got free in the next tide, or the one after, they would be beached for 3 weeks or more.
"Fools!" he shrieked.
In the distance, the Cassandra came smartly around on a southerly tack and disappeared from view.
A southerly tack? "They are going to Montenceros," Cazalla said, and he shook with uncontrollable rage.
Hunter sat in the stern of the Cassandra and plotted his course. He was surprised to find that he no longer felt any fatigue at all, though he had not slept for 2 days. Around him, his crew lay sprawled in attitudes of collapse. Nearly all were deeply asleep.
"They are good men," Sanson said, looking at them.
"Indeed," Hunter said.
"Did any of them talk?"
"One did."
"And Cazalla believed him?"
"Not at that moment," Hunter said, "but he may change his view later."
"We have at least 6 hours on them," Sanson said.
18, if we are lucky." Hunter nodded. Matanceros was 2 days' sail into the wind. With such a start, they might beat the warship to the fortress. We will sail through all the nights, Hunter said. Saint-Saëns nodded.
Harden that jib-sheet, Enders barked. Lively there!
The sail tautened, and with a fresh breeze from the east, the Cassandra cut through the water into the dawn light. Part 3. Matanceros. Chapter 20. In the afternoon, the sky was streaked with patchy clouds that turned dark and gray as the sun faded. The air was damp and forbidding. It was then that Lazu spotted the first of the timbers. Sailing on, the Cassandra moved among dozens of broken pieces of wood and ship's wreckage. The crew threw out lines and brought some of it aboard.
"Looks English," Saint-Saëns said, when a piece of the high transom painted red and blue was hauled onto the deck.
Hunter nodded. A good-sized ship had been sunk. "Not long ago," he said. He scanned the horizon for any sign of survivors, but there was none. Our Danish friends have been hunting. Pieces of wood thumped against the hull of the ship for another 15 minutes. The crew was uneasy. Sailors did not like to see the evidence of such destruction. Another cross brace was brought aboard, and from it, Enders guessed the ship had been a merchantman, probably a brig or frigate, 150 feet or so. They never found any sign of the crew. The air turned increasingly sullen as night fell, and a sea squall blew up. In the darkness, hot rain hammered the wooden decks of the Cassandra. The men were soaked and miserable through the night, yet the dawn was fair and clear, and when it broke, they saw their destination dead ahead on the horizon. From a distance, the western face of the island of Laris is singularly uninviting. Its volcanic contours are sharp and jagged, and except for low vegetation along the shore, the island appears dry and brown and barren, with patches of exposed, bare, reddish-gray rock. Little rain fell on the island, and because it was so far eastward in the Caribbean, the winds off the Atlantic whipped around its single peak ceaselessly. The crew of the Cassandra watched Laris approach without any trace of enthusiasm. Enders at the helm frowned.
"It's September," he said. "She's as green and welcoming as ever she gets."
"Aye," Hunter said. "It's no haven. But there's a forest on the eastern shore, and plenty of water."
"And plenty of popish muskets," Enders said.
"And plenty of popish gold," Hunter said. "How long do you make landfall?"
"Fair wind, midday at latest, I'd warrant."
"Bear for the cove," Hunter said, pointing. Already they could see the only indentation on the western coast, a narrow inlet called Blind Man's Cove. Hunter went off to collect the supplies that his small landing party would carry with them. He found Don Diego the Jew already setting out the equipment on the deck. The Jew fixed Hunter with a weak eye.
"Considerate of the Dons," he said. "They looked, but didn't take anything."
"Except the rats."
"We can make do with anything small, Hunter. Possum, any small creature."
"We'll have to," Hunter said. Saint-Saëns was standing in the bow, looking forward at the peak of Mount Laris. From a distance, it appeared absolutely sheer, a curving semicircle of naked red rock.
"There's no around it?" Saint-Saëns asked.
Hunter responded, "The only passages around will be guarded. We must go over the top." Saint-Saëns gave a slight smile. Hunter went aft again to Enders. He gave orders that once his party had been beached, the Cassandra was to sail south to the next island, Ramonas. A small cove with fresh water could be found there, and the sloop would be safe from attack.
"You know the place?"
"Aye," Enders said. "I know it.
Holed up a week in that cove some years back under Captain Lewisham with his one eye. She's fair enough. How long do we wait there?"
4 days. On the afternoon of the 4th day, move out of the cove and anchor in deep water. Sail at midnight, and bring yourself to Matanceros just before dawn on the 5th day.
"And then?"
"Sail right up into the harbor at dawn and board the men onto the galleon. passing the guns of the fort?
They'll not trouble you on the fifth morning.
I'm not a praying man, Enders said, but I'm hoping.
Hunter clapped him on the shoulder.
There's nothing to fear.
Enders looked toward the island and did not smile.
By noon, in the still midday heat, Hunter, Sasson, Lazoo, the Moor, and Don Diego stood on the narrow strip of white sand beach and watched the Cassandra depart. At their feet was more than 120 pounds of equipment: rope, grappling hooks, canvas slings, muskets, water caskets. They stood in silence for a moment, breathing in lungfuls of burning air. Then Hunter turned away.
"Let's make off," he said.
They moved away from the water's edge toward the shoreline. Beyond the beach, the shoreline of palm trees and tangled mangroves appeared as impenetrable as a stone wall. They knew from bitter experience that they could not hack their way through this barrier. To attempt it was to make no more than a few hundred yards of progress in the course of a day of feverish physical effort. The usual method of entering the interior of an island was to find a stream and move up it. They knew there must be such a stream here, for the very existence of a cove implied it. Coves were formed in part because there was a break in the outer reefs, and that break meant fresh water pouring out from the land. They walked along the beach, and after an hour located a sparse trickle of water, cutting a muddy track through the foliage along the shore. The stream bed was so narrow that the plants overgrew it, making a sort of cramped, hot tunnel. The passage was obviously not easy.
"Should we look for a better one?" Sasson said.
The Jew shook his head. "There is little rainfall here. I doubt there is a better one." They all seemed to agree and set out, moving up the creek, away from the sea. Almost immediately, the heat became unbearable, the air hot and rank. It was, as Lazoo said, like breathing cloth. After the first few minutes, they traveled in silence, wasting no energy on talk. The only sound was the thwack of their cutlasses on the foliage, and the chatter of birds and small animals in the canopy of trees above them. Their progress was slow. Toward the end of the day, when they looked over their shoulders, the blue ocean below seemed discouragingly near. They pressed on, pausing only to capture food. Sasson was a master of the crossbow and used it to shoot a monkey and several birds. They were encouraged to notice the droppings of a wild boar near the stream bed. Lazoo collected plants that were edible. Nightfall found them halfway up the strip of jungle between the sea and the bare rock of Mount Larris. Although the air turned cooler, they were trapped beneath the foliage and it remained almost as hot as before. In addition, the mosquitoes were out. The mosquitoes were a formidable enemy, coming in thick clouds so dense as to be almost palpable, obscuring each man's vision of those near him. The insects buzzed and whined around them, clinging to every part of their bodies, getting into ears and nose and mouth. They coated themselves liberally with mud and water, but nothing really helped. They dared not light a fire, but ate the caught game raw and slept the night fitfully, propped up against trees with the droning buzz of mosquitoes in their ears. In the morning they awoke, the caked mud dropping off their stiff bodies, and they looked at each other and laughed. They were all changed, their faces red and swollen and lumpy with mosquito bites. Hunter checked the water. A quarter of their supply was gone, and he announced they would have to consume less. They moved on, hoping to see a wild boar, for they were all hungry. They never sighted one. The monkeys chattering in the overhead canopy of foliage seemed to taunt them. They heard the animals, but Sasson never had a clear shot at one. Late in the second day, they began to notice the sound of the wind. It was faint at first, a far-off low moan. But as they approached the edge of the jungle, where the trees were thinner and their progress easier, the wind grew louder. Soon they could feel it, and although the breeze was welcome, they looked back at each other with anxiety. They knew the breeze would grow in strength as they approached the cliff face of Mount Larris. It was late afternoon when they finally reached the rocky base of the cliff. The wind was now a screaming demon that tugged and whipped their clothing, bruised their faces, shrieked in their ears. They had to shout to be heard.
Hunter looked up at the rock wall before them. It was as sheer as it had seemed from a distance, and if anything, higher than he had thought. 400 feet of naked rock, lashed by a wind so strong that stone chips and rock fragments fell down on them continually. He motioned to the Moor, who came over.
Bassa! Hunter shouted, leaning close to the huge man.
Will the wind be less at night?
Bassa shrugged and made a pinching gesture with two fingers. A little better.
Can you make the climb at night?
He shook his head. No. Then he made a little pillow with his hands and leaned his head on it.
You want to climb in the morning?
Bassa nodded.
He's right, Sanson said. We should wait until morning, when we are rested.
I don't know if we can wait, Hunter said.
He was looking to the north. Some miles away, across a placid sea, he saw the broad gray line over the water, and above that, angry black clouds. It was a storm, several miles wide, moving slowly toward them.
All the more reason, Sanson shouted to Hunter. We should let it pass.
Hunter turned away. From their position at the base of the cliff, they were 500 feet above sea level. Looking south, he could see Ramonas, some 30 miles away. The Cassandra was not in sight. It had long since found the protection of the cove. Hunter looked back at the storm. They might wait out the night, and the storm might pass them by. But if it were large enough, and slow enough, and they lost even one day, then their timing would be ruined. And 3 days hence, the Cassandra would sail into Matanceros carrying 50 men to certain death. We climb now, Hunter said. He turned to the Moor. The Moor nodded and went to collect his ropes. It was an extraordinary sensation, Hunter thought, as he held the rope in his hands and felt the occasional jerk and wiggle as the Moor moved up the cliff face. The rope between Hunter's fingers was 1.5 inches thick, yet high overhead, it thinned to a wispy thread, and the giant bulk of the Moor was a speck he could barely discern in the softening light.
Sanson came over to shout in his ear. "You are insane!" he yelled. "None of us will survive this!" "Afraid?" Hunter shouted back. "I fear nothing," Sanson said, thumping his chest. "But look at the others!"
Hunter looked. Lazoo was trembling. Don Diego was very pale.
"They cannot make it!" Sanson shouted. "What will you do without them?"
"They'll make it," Hunter said. "They have to." He looked over at the storm, which was closer. It was now only 1 or 2 miles away. They could feel the moisture in the wind. He felt a sudden tug on the rope in his hands, then a second quick jerk.
"He's done it," Hunter said.
He looked up, but could not see the Moor at all. 1 moment later, another rope dropped to the ground.
"Quick," Hunter said, "the supplies."
They tied the provisions, already loaded into canvas bags, onto the rope, and gave a signaling tug. The bags began their bumpy, bouncing ascent up the cliff face. Once or twice, the force of the wind blew them away from the rock a distance of 5 or 10 feet.
"God's blood," Sanson said, seeing it.
Hunter looked at Lazoo. Her face was tight. He went over and fitted the canvas sling around her shoulder and another around her hips.
"Mother of God, Mother of God, Mother of God," Lazoo said, over and over in a monotone.
"Now listen," Hunter shouted as the rope came down again. "Hold the long line and let Bassa pull you up. Keep your face to the rock and don't look down."
"Mother of God, Mother of God."
"Did you hear me?" Hunter shouted. "Don't look down."
She nodded, still muttering. 1 moment later, she started up the rock, hoisted by the sling. She had a brief period of awkwardness, twisting and clutching for the other line. Then she seemed to get her bearings, and her ascent up the face was uneventful. The Jew was next. He stared at Hunter with hollow eyes as Hunter gave him the instructions. He did not seem to hear. He was like a man sleepwalking as he stepped into the sling and was hoisted up. The first drops of rain from the approaching storm began to fall.
"You will go next," Sanson shouted.
No, Hunter said. I am last. By now it was raining steadily. The winds had increased. When the sling came down the cliff again, the canvas was soaked. Sanson stepped into the sling and jerked the rope to signal his ascent. As he started up, he shouted to Hunter, "If you die, I will take your shares!" And then he laughed, his laughter trailing off in the wind. With the approach of the storm, a gray fog clung around the top of the cliff. Sanson was soon lost from view. Hunter waited. A very long time seemed to pass, and then he heard the wet slap of the sling on the ground nearby. He walked over and fitted himself into it. Wind-blown rain slashed against his face and body as he tugged on the line and started up. He would remember that climb for the rest of his life. He had no sense of position, for he was wrapped in a dark gray world. All he could see was the rocky face just a few inches away. The wind tore at him, often swinging him wide away from the cliff, then slamming him back against the rock. The ropes, the rock, everything was wet and slippery. He held the guide line in his hands and tried to keep himself facing the cliff. Often he lost his footing and twisted around, banging his back and shoulders into the rock. It seemed to take forever. He had no idea whether he had traversed half the distance or only a fraction of it, or whether he was nearly there. He strained to hear the voices of the others at the top, but all he heard was the maniacal shriek of the wind and the splatter of the rain. He felt the vibration of the tow rope as he was pulled up. It was a steady, rhythmic shudder. He moved up a few feet, then a pause, then up a few feet more, then another pause, then another brief ascent. Suddenly, there was a break in the pattern. No more ascent. The rope vibration changed. It was transmitted to his body through the canvas sling. At first he thought it was some trick of the senses, but then he knew what it was. The hemp, after 5 rough passages over the rock, was frayed and now was slowly, agonizingly, stretching. In his mind's eye he saw it thinning, and at that moment gripped the guide rope tightly. In the same instant the sling rope snapped and came twisting and snaking down on his head and shoulders, heavy and wet. His grip on the guide rope loosened, and he fell a few feet. How far he was not sure. Then he tried to take stock of his situation. He was lying flat on his stomach against the cliff, the wet sling around his legs and hanging from him like a dead weight, straining his already aching arms. He kicked his legs, trying to disentangle himself from the sling, but he could not get free of it. It was awful. With the sling there, he was effectively hobbled. He could not use his feet to get purchase on the rock. He would hang there, he knew, until finally fatigue made him release his grip on the rope, and he fell to the bottom. Already his wrists and fingers burned with pain. He felt a slight tug on the guide rope, but they did not pull him up. He kicked again, desperately, and then a sudden gust of wind swung him out from the cliff. The damn sling was acting as a sail, catching the wind and pulling him away. He watched the rock wall disappear in the fog as he was blown out 10-20 feet from the cliff. He kicked again, and suddenly was lighter. The sling had fallen away. His body began to arc back toward the cliff. He braced himself for the impact, and then it came, slamming the breath out of his lungs. He gave an involuntary cry and hung there, gasping for breath. And then, with a final great effort, he pulled himself up until his hands, gripping the rope, were pressed to his chest. He locked his feet around the rope a moment, resting his arms. His breath returned. He positioned his feet on the rock surface and went up the rope, hand over hand. His feet slipped away. His knees banged against the rock. But he had moved upward a distance. He did it again. He did it again. He did it again. His mind ceased to function. His body worked automatically of its own accord. The world around him became silent. No sound of rain, no scream of wind, nothing at all, not even the gasp of his own breath. The world was gray, and he was lost in the grayness. He was not even aware when strong arms fastened under his shoulders, and he was pulled up and flopped on his belly on the flat surface. He did not hear voices. He saw nothing. Later, they told him that even after he had been laid out on the ground, his body continued to crawl forward, hunching and going flat, hunching and going flat, with his bleeding face pressed to the rock, until they forcibly held him still. But for the moment, he knew nothing at all. He did not even know he had survived. He awoke to the light chatter of birds, opened his eyes, and saw green leaves in sunlight. He lay very still, only his eyes moving. He saw a rock wall. He was in a cave, near the mouth of a cave. He smelled cooking food, an indescribably delicious smell, and he started to sit up. Violent streaks of pain shot through every part of his body. With a gasp, he fell back again.
"Slowly, my friend," a voice said.
Sanson came around from behind him.
"Very slowly."
He bent over and helped Hunter sit upright. The first thing Hunter saw were his clothes. His trousers were shredded almost beyond recognition. Through the holes, he could see that his skin was in similar condition. His arms and chest were the same. He looked at his body as if he were examining a foreign, unfamiliar object.
"Your face is not so pretty either," Sanson said, and laughed. "Do you think you can eat?"
Hunter started to speak. His face was stiff. It was as if he were wearing a mask. He touched his cheek and felt a thick crust of blood. He shook his head.
"No food? Then water?"
Sanson produced a cask and helped Hunter take a drink. He was relieved to find it did not hurt to swallow, but his mouth was numb where the cask touched his lips.
"Not too much," Sanson said. "Not too much."
The others came over. The Jew was grinning broadly.
"You should see the view."
Hunter felt a jolt of elation. He wanted to see the view. He raised one painful arm to Sanson, who helped him stand. The first moment on his feet was excruciating. He felt lightheaded and electric jolts of pain shot through his legs and back. Then it was better. Leaning on Sanson, he took a step, wincing. He thought suddenly of Governor Almont. He thought of the evening spent bargaining with Almont for this raid on Montanceros. He had been so confident then, so relaxed, so much the intrepid adventurer. He started to smile ruefully at the memory. The smile hurt. Then he saw the view. And immediately he forgot Almont and his pains and his aching body. They were standing at the mouth of a small cave, high on the eastern rim of Mount Larris. Curving down below them were the green slopes of the volcano, going down more than 1,000 feet into dense tropical rainforest. At the very bottom was a wide river, opening out into the harbor and the fortress of Punta Montanceros. Sunlight sparkled off the still waters of the harbor, glittering brilliantly around the treasure galleon moored there just inside the protection of the fortress. It was all laid out before him, and Hunter thought it was the most beautiful sight in the world. Chapter 21 Sanson gave Hunter another drink of water from the cask, and then Don Diego said,
"There is something else you should see, Captain."
The little party climbed up the sloping hill toward the edge of the cliff they had scaled the night before. They moved slowly, in deference to Hunter, who felt pain in every step. And as he looked up at the clear, cloudless blue sky, he felt pain of a different sort. He knew he had made a serious and nearly fatal mistake to force the climb during the storm. They should have waited and made the ascent the next morning. He had been foolish and overeager, and he berated himself for the error. As they approached the lip of the cliff, Don Diego squatted down and looked over cautiously to the west. The others did the same, Sanson helping Hunter. Hunter did not understand why they were being so careful until he looked over the sheer precipice to the jungle foliage to the bay beyond. In the bay was Kazala's warship.
"Damn me,"
he whispered softly. Sanson crouched alongside him, nodded.
Luck is with us, my friend. This ship arrived in the bay at dawn. It has been there ever since.
As Hunter watched, he could see a longboat ferrying soldiers to the shore. Along the beach, there were dozens of red-coated Spanish troops searching the shoreline. Cazala, dressed in a yellow tunic, was clearly visible, gesticulating wildly as he gave orders.
They are searching the beach, Sanson said. They have guessed our plan.
But the storm, Hunter said.
Yes, this storm will have washed away any trace of our presence there.
Hunter thought of the canvas sling that had fallen from his feet. It would be lying now at the base of the cliff. But the soldiers would probably never find it. To reach the cliff was a full day-long hard journey through the undergrowth. They would not make that journey without evidence a party had landed on the shore. As Hunter watched, a second longboat loaded with soldiers put out from the warship.
He has been landing men all morning, Don Diego said. There must be 100 on the beach now.
Then he intends to leave men, Hunter said.
Don Diego nodded.
All the better for us, Hunter said.
Any troops left on the western side of the island would be unable to fight in Montanceros.
Let us hope he leaves 1,000.
Back in the mouth of the cave, Don Diego made a gruel for Hunter to drink while Sanson put out their little fire, and Lazoo held the spyglass to her eyes. She described the scene to Hunter, who was sitting alongside her. Hunter himself could see only the basic outlines of the structures by the water below. He relied upon the keenness of Lazoo's vision to guide him.
Tell me first, he said, about the guns in the fortress.
Lazoo's lips worked silently as she peered through the glass.
12, she said finally. 2 batteries of 3 each face east toward the open ocean. 6 in a single battery fire across the harbor entrance.
Are there any culverins?
They have long barrels. I think they are culverins.
What can you say of their age?
She was silent a moment.
We are too distant, she replied.
Perhaps later, when we move down, I will see more.
And the mountings?
Carriages, I think wood, with 4 wheels.
Hunter nodded. Those would be ordinary shipboard gun carriages, transferred to the shore batteries. Don Diego came over with the gruel.
I am glad they are wood, he said. I feared they might be stone-mounted. That would make it more difficult.
Hunter said, We will blow the carriages?
Of course, Don Diego said.
The culverins weighed more than 2 tons each. If their carriages were destroyed, they would be useless. They could not be aimed or fired. And even if the Montanceros fortress had extra gun carriages, it would take dozens of men many hours to seat each cannon back into a new carriage.
But first, Don Diego said with a smile, we will breach them.
The idea had never occurred to Hunter, but he immediately saw its value. The culverins were, like all cannon, muzzle loaders. The crews first rammed a bag of gunpowder down the mouth of the cannon, followed by a ball of shot. Then, through a touch hole in the breech, the powder bag was broken with a pointed quill and a burning fuse inserted. The fuse burned through the touch hole, ignited the powder, and fired the ball. This method of firing was reliable enough so long as the touch hole remained small. But after repeated firings, the burning fuse and the exploding powder corroded the touch hole, widening it until it acted as an escape valve for the expanding gases. Once that happened, the range of the cannon was severely reduced. Ultimately, the ball would not fire at all. And the cannon was very dangerous for its crews to operate. Faced with this inevitable deterioration, cannon makers fitted the breech with a replaceable metal plug, wider at one end than the other, with a touch hole bored in the center. The plug was fitted from inside the cannon so that the expanding gases of the gunpowder would tend to ram the plug home more snugly with each firing. Whenever the touch hole became too large, the metal plug was simply removed and a new one fitted. But sometimes the whole plug was blown out in a piece, leaving a very large hole at the breech of the cannon. That was true breaching, and it rendered the gun wholly useless until a new plug could be fitted. That process took many hours.
Believe me, Don Diego said, when we are finished with those guns, they will be useful for nothing but ballast in a merchant's hold.
Hunter turned back to Lazoo. What can you see inside the fortress itself?
Tents. Many tents.
That will be the garrison, Hunter said. During most of the year, the weather in the New World was so fair that troops did not require more permanent protection, and this was particularly true for an island as rainless as Laris. Although now Hunter could imagine the consternation of the troops, who had slept in mud from the storm of the previous night. What about the powder magazine?
There is a wood building north, inside the walls. That may be it.
Good, Hunter said. He did not want to spend time searching for the magazine once they entered the fortress. Are there defenses outside the walls? Lazoo scanned the ground below.
I see nothing.
Good. Now what of the ship?
A skeleton crew, she said. I see 5 or 6 men on the longboats tied to the shore, by the town.
Hunter had noticed the town. It was a surprise. A series of rough wood buildings along the shore, some distance from the fort. Obviously, they had been erected to house the galleon's crew on land, proof that the crew intended to stay at Montanceros for a period of time, perhaps until next year's sailing of the treasure fleet.
Troops in the town? I see a few red jackets.
Guards at the longboats?
None.
They are making things easy for us, Hunter said.
So far, Sanson said.
The party collected their gear, obliterating any traces of their time in the cave. They started the long hike down the sloping hill to Montanceros. On their descent, they faced the opposite problem from their climb 2 days before. High on the eastern slope of Mount Laris, there was little foliage and little protection. They were obliged to slip from one dense clump of thorny vegetation to the next, and their progress was slow. At noon, they had a surprise. Kazala's black warship appeared in the mouth of the harbor, and reefing her sails, came to anchor near the fort. A longboat was put out. Lazoo, with the glass, said the Kazala was in the stern.
This ruins everything, Hunter said, looking at the position of the warship.
It was parallel to the shore, so that a full broadside of its cannon would rake the channel.
What if she stays there? Sanson said.
Hunter was wondering exactly that, and he could think of only one answer. We'll fire her, he said. If she stays at anchor, we'll have to fire her.
Light a longboat from shore and set it adrift?
Hunter nodded.
A slim chance, Sanson said.
Then Lazoo, still watching through the glass, said,
There's a woman.
What? Hunter said.
In the longboat, there's a woman with Kazala.
Let me see. Hunter took the glass eagerly. But to his eyes, there was only a white, irregular shape seated in the stern next to Kazala, who stood and faced the fortress. Hunter could discern no details. He returned the glass to Lazoo.
Describe her.
White dress and parasol, or some large hat or covering on her head.
Dark face, could be a negro.
His mistress? Lazoo shook her head. The longboat was now tying up by the fort.
She's getting off. She's struggling.
Perhaps she's not got balance.
No, Lazoo said firmly. She is struggling.
3 men are holding her, forcing her to enter the fortress.
You say she's dark? Hunter asked again.
That was perplexing. Kazala might have taken a woman captive, but any woman worth ransoming would certainly be very fair.
Dark, yes, Lazoo said. But I cannot really see further.
We will wait, Hunter said. Puzzled, they continued down the slope. 3 hours later, in the hottest part of the afternoon, they paused in a cluster of prickly acara bushes to drink a ration of water. Lazoo noticed that the longboat was putting out from the fortress, this time carrying a man she described as stern, very slender, very proper, and erect.
Basque, Hunter said.
Basquet was Cazalla's second in command, a renegade Frenchman, known as a cool and implacable leader.
Is Cazalla with him?
No, Lazoo said. The longboat tied up alongside the warship, and Basquet boarded. Moments later, the ship's crew began to hoist the longboat. That could mean only one thing.
They're setting off, Sanson said. Your luck holds, my friend.
Not quite yet, Hunter said. Let us see if she will be making for Ramonas, where the Cassandra and her crew were hidden. The Cassandra was in water too shallow for the warship to attack her, but Basquet could blockade the pirate sloop in the cove, and without the Cassandra, there was no point in attacking Matanceros. They needed the men of the Cassandra to sail the treasure galleon out of the harbor. The warship left the harbor on a southerly reach, but that was necessary to make deep water. Outside the channel, it continued south.
Damn, Sanson said.
No, she's just making speed, Hunter said. Wait. As he